Welcome to Beyond Blathers, the podcast where we dive deeper into the insects, fish, and fossils you can find in Animal Crossing New Horizons. I'm Olivia DeBercier.
And I'm Sophia Osborne.
This week, we're so excited to be talking about plankton, and we have a special guest. But first, we have some exciting news.
Yeah, we have finally started a Patreon. I feel like this announcement has been a long time coming.
It really has.
Yeah, but we are really, really happy to finally be launching the Patreon and to have a way to connect with you even more. So if you don't know what Patreon is, it's a way for fans to support their favorite online creators with monthly donations. And as a reward, fans get access to special perks. I definitely love supporting my favorite podcasts and artists and everything on Patreon. I just really like that it's kind of a way to directly support creators and a way for them to know that they have a consistent monthly income coming in.
Yeah, it helps a lot. I mean, we love spending time on this podcast, but it is a lot of time, and it's, you know, it would be great if we could get just like a little bit to cover our costs and everything. So this is a great way to do that. Just like keep the podcast running and, you know, reinvest into our work, which is really exciting. So if you're interested in joining the Patreon and becoming one of our patrons, we have three different tiers you can join. The first is called Sweet Sea Angel, and it's $3 Canadian or $2.50 USD per month. This is basically like a tip jar where you can support us, and you'll also get access to exclusive posts we're going to make for patrons. And this can include things like behind the scenes content, maybe just like fun facts, kind of whatever we're feeling. And you'll also get a shout out on the podcast when you join.
Yeah, and the next tier is called Bestie Brachiosaurus, which I just really love these names. And Olivia did very cute illustrations for each tier, so you can go check those out. But yeah, Bestie Brachiosaurus is $15 Canadian or $12 USD per month. And it's basically our sticker of the month club. So on top of getting the exclusive Patreon posts and the shout out on the podcast, you'll also get an exclusive sticker delivered to your doorstep each month, along with a handwritten note from Olivia. So yeah, I think this is really going to be a lot of fun. We're going to do up the mail really cute and everything. And you'll also get 10% off our Etsy shop.
And finally, there's the Super Sunfish tier, which is $18 Canadian or $14 USD per month. And in this tier, you'll get all of that plus a postcard-sized art print in the mail.
Yeah, and we should also mention that these tiers are all open for you, whether you're from Canada, the US, international countries. But yeah, these stickers and art prints are going to be so cute. If you follow us on Instagram or Twitter, you've probably seen Olivia's amazing illustrations. And you can see the designs for the June rewards on our Instagram, Twitter, and on the Patreon now. They're owl themed, which we of course had to do for the first month. And yeah, I'm just really obsessed.
Yeah, and really, we absolutely love making this podcast. I know we've said it before, but really, we really mean it. We're so grateful for all of your support over the last 3 years. It's been just my favorite thing to do. It's been such a joy. And we really want to continue to build this community and work on bigger science education projects in the future. So by becoming a patron, your money not only goes to producing this podcast, but it helps us to expand our communication work into the future. You know, Sophia and I are really early in our careers. We'd love to expand this further. And, you know, I really want to keep doing science communication. It's like my favorite thing to do. I'm just so passionate about it. So really, I just am really excited about this. And I'm really excited about all the support from all of you up until this point. It's been incredible and very inspiring.
Yeah, I really echo all of that. And we also definitely wanted to say that if you aren't able to become a patron, we still really, really appreciate you. We really appreciate all the support that you give us just by listening to this show and spreading the word about it and liking our posts on Instagram and everything. So everything you do helps us out so much. And we really appreciate all of you, whether you're able to join the Patreon or not.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I very much, literally every single download, every single listen, that is support. And it's fantastic. So thank you all so much. And if you're interested in the Patreon, you can check it out at patreon.com/beyondblathers.
Yeah, thanks so much for listening to that little tangent. But now that we've covered that news, let's get on to today's extremely exciting episode. We have a really special guest joining us today, Dr. Jo Hansen, host of PBS's Be Smart on YouTube.
Yeah, so Jo is a fantastic science communicator and a scientist himself. His channel, which you can find on YouTube at Be Smart, has 4.8 million subscribers and 385 videos on topics ranging from cell biology to the colors of butterflies to human behavior. Just a massive range of science topics. And they're all like, every time I read a title, I'm like, oh, I actually am wondering that. Tell me more. It's a very intriguing YouTube channel.
They're so good. I was watching one about how we read, and I was like, oh, I never really thought about how reading works scientifically, but this is so cool and like very up my alley. So yeah, can't recommend that YouTube channel enough. But one of the recent episodes is called The Mystery Behind Earth's Most Epic Migration, and it talks about the fantastic migration that plankton undergo each and every day. Last week, Olivia and I got the opportunity to speak to Jo about this migration, about his career, and about science communication.
So Blathers doesn't have anything to say about plankton in particular, but before we play the interview, I wanted to give a bit of a refresher of what plankton are, as, you know, there's something we talk about in so many of our episodes, but maybe you haven't heard those before, or maybe you just need the refresher. So plankton is kind of a catch-all term for stuff in the world's oceans and freshwater that's so tiny that they get pushed around by the water current. So they're just floating around and just chaotically there. They don't really have control over their movements. So these plankton, they might be visible to the human eye, they may not. Some of the world's smallest plankton is 2 micrometers, so unbelievably small. Others can be as big as 20 centimeters. So there is a pretty large range in size, large range of species and creatures out there. But it's important to remember plankton's alive. It's getting moved around by the oceans, or really any water, I should say, not just the oceans. So there's 2 types of plankton for the most part. There's phytoplankton, which consists of the planktonic photosynthesizing life. So for example, this might include tiny plants, dinoflagellates, algae, cyanobacteria, lots of different things. Phytoplankton tends to be smaller than zooplankton, and to my knowledge, it will typically contain green chlorophyll, so that green color. Chlorophyll is found in many of our land plants too, and that chlorophyll allows them to use the sun's light to photosynthesize. And of course, with photosynthesis, we get the uptake of carbon dioxide and the release of oxygen, which we definitely need for a couple things. And these phytoplankton are usually near the surface where the sun's light is accessible. Now, the other category of plankton are the zooplankton. These are little animals. So these might be crustaceans like copepods. Plankton from SpongeBob is inspired by a copepod. Zooplankton could also be things like larval octopus or worms or krill. Huge variety of animals in zooplankton. And some of them spend their whole life being plankton, and others will grow up into bigger animals like the octopus. And now, you know, octopus aren't completely at the whim of the currents, and so they will no longer be plankton once they're adults. Now, we hear about phytoplankton, so that's the photosynthesizing plankton, pretty frequently in freshwater ecosystems, because when there's a lot of runoff from agriculture or other pollutant sources, and all of that runoff ends up in a lake, it can cause the algae to suddenly have a really big population boom, and suddenly you've got this sticky green lake. And while this might seem good to have more plants releasing oxygen into the atmosphere, it can be quite deadly to these lakes. And that's because some algae are toxic and will kill fish and other animals in the water. The other problem is that when algae breaks down, it uses up oxygen in the water. And so if you have all of this algae breaking down at once, it's using up all the oxygen, and then fish and other gilled creatures in that water can suffocate. So it can be a real environmental issue. On the other hand, phytoplankton produces a massive amount of oxygen. Like, trees are always out here getting all the praise, but basically half of the heavy lifting in terms of producing that oxygen is coming from the world's phytoplankton. Another important thing that plankton does is, in the case of zooplankton, it's a huge chunk of the bottom of the food chain. So we've got zooplankton eating phytoplankton, and then that zooplankton is then being eaten by fish and crustaceans and even huge animals like whales, of which many species devour krill like it's popcorn in a bowl. They just love it. So that zooplankton is very important. And if we lose the plankton, that's a massive source of food for a huge number of animals, of which many species are human food too. And we also lose a lot of our oxygen producing creatures. So very important to keep plankton around.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving us a little primer on plankton and zooplankton, Olivia. I feel like I honestly just group all plankton together, but it's important to remember that they're literally like different types of life forms completely. But yeah, now that we're refreshed on what plankton are and why they're so important, we have Joe Hansen on to talk about this amazing thing that they do called diel migration. We touched on this last episode with the firefly squid, so if you listened to that episode, you may be familiar with this concept, but he's going to get into it more and kind of the ramifications of it, and also just talk about his science communication career, and yeah, we just had a great time, so either way, you're in for a real treat. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. We're really looking forward to chatting with you.
Well, me too. I love talking about science, obviously. I do it for a living, and I'm grateful for that. It's barely a job.
Well, could you start by introducing yourself and telling our listeners a bit about your amazing show, Be Smart?
My name is Joe Hansen. I'm a biologist by training, but a YouTuber by trade. I make a show called Be Smart, which is produced by PBS. It's a YouTube show all about curiosity, storytelling, with the mission of inspiring people to just understand how they fit into the universe better, whether that's physics, space, animals, evolution, just being able to be a better human and understanding how you fit into everything through the lens of science. And I've been doing that for about 10 years now, which every time I say it makes me feel very old once you cross into double digits, like a grandpa of online science communication. But yeah, you can check out that show on YouTube and various other places around the internet.
Yeah, it's a great show. I've been watching it for ages, and I feel like it's helped us in our podcast a few times. I remember the episode about color and blue butterflies. That one always stands out because that is a very hard thing for me to wrap my head around. So it was very helpful to have like a well-illustrated, explained video. So yeah, I definitely encourage our listeners to watch that show. It's fantastic.
I encourage them too. Thank you.
Me too. So you recently did an episode about zooplankton and their amazing vertical migration, which is actually something we talked about in our last episode with firefly squid, just a little bit, because they also participate in this amazing, huge vertical migration that's happening every day in the ocean. So yeah, we were just wondering if you could talk a bit about that amazing story.
Yeah, we're always, me and my writers and researchers are always just crawling through books and journals looking for that moment that makes us say kind of like, aha. And if we feel that moment, then there's a pretty good chance then when we make a video about it that other people have that. And I remember hearing about this for the first time. Like, I'm not a marine biologist. I was the kind of biologist who mixed clear liquids together and then, you know, put them in an incubator. I never saw a whole animal in my entire graduate school career. So finding out that there is not only a migration in the ocean that is larger than anything by orders of magnitude that happens on land that no one had told me about before, and that it happens every single day, was like finding out that there's like a, I don't know, like a secret door in your house or something. Like, you just feel like, how did I not understand that this was a thing? I feel cheated. But getting to discover that story for ourselves, we're just trying to share that experience with our audience. And so the diel vertical migration, the thing that I think first caught my eye was like a strange discovery story, that one of these things that's like really surprisingly recent, and it was totally accidental, that submarines in World War II were getting like these weird signals on sonar that they thought like the bottom of the ocean floor was moving up and down. There's getting, which obviously would not happen. I hope that wouldn't happen. It sounds like a bad day for Earth. And so this told scientists that something funny was going on in the ocean. So they started dipping nets in and going to these places and trying to figure out what could be causing that. And a few smart ones said, you know, it's probably a lot of life moving up and down in the ocean. And it turns out that, you know, this cornerstone, keystone species of ocean food webs, plankton, is making these epic migrations up and down every day. And then they figure out that it's not just the plankton, it's the things that eat the plankton because they want to chase those plankton. And then it's the things that don't want to get eaten by the zooplankton, the animal plankton, like the phytoplankton, the photosynthetic ones are being like, well, they're coming up. Well, we're going down then. This is, you know, you're getting this sort of like ocean-wide, three-dimensional, multi-mile migration that's happening in this continuous cycle as the Earth turns and things come into daylight and night. So characterizing just that this massive thing was even happening for people hopefully teaches them something about the ocean and the interesting animals in it, but also the goal is to just maybe love the ocean a little more and understand that there are these intricate kind of foundational cycles that entire species and ecosystems depend on, and that we have to, it gives you one more thing to love and protect. And that's another goal that we have with a video like this. Because, you know, conservation is not just about things, you know, it's about behaviors and these things that have to evolve alongside the actual like animals themselves.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not, you know, there's so much intrinsic value in that, but there's also the fact that those plankton way out in the middle of the ocean, so far away from us terrestrial mammals, but it's still affecting us in some ways. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, like this feels like a very far away thing. You know, there's plenty of things in science that are just like, oh, well, that's neat. Thanks for telling me. But this is one that really does connect to our everyday life. You know, you see a salmon fillet in the grocery store or you're eating tuna fish. I don't think it really clicks with most people. These are like carnivorous predatory fish who have to eat something, and they are eating these little things in the ocean. I think most people know that like a lot of whales eat krill and other tiny things out of the ocean, but so many other species that we depend on for food, for commerce, they are absolutely dependent on the existence of these enormous plankton communities. That's what they're eating to become, you know, things that we can eat and that support entire ways of life in different places around the world. But also, you know, people talk about coral reefs a lot and how many different species are interdependent and reliant on that physical ecosystem. Well, many of them are doing the same thing. Like they're all relying on this sort of basic food source. I sort of equate it like if you took grass out of the Serengeti, that's the equivalent of losing plankton in the ocean. And it's something that could, and not just the plankton themselves, but the things that they do and the animals that have evolved alongside them to chase them up and down and depend on them. That would be, of course, catastrophic for so many layers of just nature, the existence of ecosystems, but very practical for us. You're not going to get that salmon fillet or that can of tuna fish without these foundations. But of course, it's the photosynthetic plankton that are also involved in this too. And I think people don't fully appreciate the amount of work that they do for the atmosphere. We hear about the Amazon rainforest, people calling it the lungs of the planet. And it does an amazing amount of photosynthesis, pulling carbon out of the air, which is something, of course, we need more of. We need to pull more of that carbon out. But it's really ocean phytoplankton who are doing the heavy lifting when it comes to pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and providing us with oxygen. It always has been. Like these are the tiny, tiny workhorses that exist, you know, far away from land, far away from our eyes, but they're the reason you can take a breath.
Yeah, I think that was one of the most powerful parts of watching the video to me was the connection to climate change and the work that these phytoplankton are doing for carbon sequestration, and knowing that if we disrupt that system and this huge migration, that we could be even more screwed.
We're always looking for ways to be even more screwed, right? That's always great news. No, yeah, but this is one of those things that reminds people the things that you can't see can often be incredibly important. And, you know, sure, we get comments down there like, oh, do you got to make everything about climate change? Well, it's like, I'm sorry, like nature depends on the climate. Like climate is everything. It is the ocean and the sky and the land and the animals. It's all of these things and more. And it's us and our behaviors. So it's not some like political choice to connect things to climate change. It's what being an honest scientist is, because everything is connected to it.
Yeah, we would love it if things weren't being hurt by climate change. That would be great news. Yeah, so it was really interesting to see that exact description of how that plays into everything. And yeah, studying bugs, you notice, well, these little things are, we know so little about them, and they affect us so much more than we could ever imagine.
Like, they're so resilient, right? I mean, insects are a great case in point. Like they've survived how many mass extinctions and have bounced back with their little, you know, it's good to wear your skeleton on the outside. I guess that makes you a more resilient creature. But, you know, plankton are the same way. They've been the foundation of the ocean for who knows how long. They are survivors. But it's this pace of change that is so new and so uncertain. And it is the threat of rapid collapse of things that we depend on. Like, the world's not going to end. Life's not going to end. I just don't want life to suck.
Exactly. We were curious, just as, I guess, people who produce a small podcast that we do the research for, and, you know, it doesn't have any visuals, which sometimes is frustrating when we're trying to describe things.
Yeah, using a lot of hand motions and no one can see me.
Exactly. But what is the process like for creating a video like this one on vertical migration, and kind of what goes into that, and how much time does it take?
So these days I'm lucky to work with a team of people, not a very big team, a few people. And, you know, 90% of the lifting of telling a science story is in the research. Luckily, we're good at that because we're scientists. But finding that information, digging and diving, like, that's the essential part of the story creation process. And it's the most difficult ingredient to sort of perfect. You know, these things don't just fall out of the sky. It's not like you open up a book of, you know, there's not a Wikipedia page for interesting questions about science that people want to know about. You know, it's connecting often a lot of different things together. And then sort of a video will emerge from what seems like often disconnected things to provide you with this wonderful story. So a video like this was probably 2 months in the making in terms of kind of research and kind of figuring out what part of this you want to talk about. You know, it's one thing to say, why don't we just explain to you what this vertical migration is? You can put that fact in your pocket and you can walk around and you'll get to annoy somebody at a party one day with an interesting science fact. But that's not quite enough for us. You know, our mission is to take a story that people who are not professional scientists, who might not be regularly interacting with science, can click on when they open YouTube and have a genuinely, you know, mind-changing experience. It'll shift their understanding of their existence. And so that requires digging farther than just the facts and the behaviors and the papers, and saying, you know, looking for that interesting origin story of weird submarine captains that got confused about their sonar. Finding the interesting scientists who are working on this so we can talk to them and they can reflect their passion in the video and what makes them curious about it. Because then the people watching it will see that excitement, and there's something that happens with the human brain. Like, that excitement is literally contagious. And I think it helps engage people with the content by seeing somebody who loves it talk about what they love. And then just trying to dig to the bottom of every hole of connection, finding out that this is connected to our own sleep cycle genetics, and that it's connected to climate change and, you know, food webs that we depend on, and all of these different things. And then you're not hanging science stories from like a single string. This is an analogy I love to use. It's science can be very heavy. You know, it can be hard. It can be hard to handle. And if you just hang that from one thread, then that thread can snap. It can be kind of hard for people to hold that. But if you can tie a bunch of different threads to a heavy science story, you can connect it to different things that people care about. And they might, it might now be connecting to three or four different things that they resonate with that are a part of their life. I feel like it helps them hold on to that science story better. So for a video like this one, we were able to work with a researcher who's devoted her career to figuring out this migration and some of the organisms involved in it. So you have this wonderful expert source who can just sort of take you through like a really excited teacher. And you're just like, God, keep telling us more. We record that. We go read papers. We read a lot of reviews and kind of wider focused journal articles that give us, that help us catch up, because we're not, you know, I'm not a marine biologist. In a short amount of time, we've got to like catch up with knowing a lot about this thing. And then we look at what other people have written about it to try to find those interesting characters and tales from history that can unpack those just extra colorful moments that make these stories rich. But then we also, like, it's a visual medium, so we got to spend a lot of time thinking about what we show too. I don't have a submarine. I don't have a big boat to go out in the middle of the ocean. Maybe Mr. Beast does, but I don't. So we have to spend some time then after we sort of figure out what the lessons we want to teach, because we're an educational channel, and what the kind of science story we want to tell is like, oh, crap. Now we have to figure out how to show this to people. So we go work with agencies like this when we were able to collaborate with MBARI, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, or amazingly generous science communication people and love to share their work. They sent us a bunch of, you know, amazing underwater ROV video clips and imagery of stuff that's involved in these migrations. We're able to collect things that are, you know, in different media libraries out there, figure out how do you illustrate a daily migration that happens around the entire planet over and over. Like, how do you show people the scale and significance of that? And that's from our little team of four or five people working on different parts of a video to sit down and kind of all contribute and teamwork on that. And one of the really fun parts of that is not everybody I work with is a scientist or has a science background. So through that process, we're sort of practicing telling the story to people who, you know, I love everything. Like, I'm a nerd. So like, I get excited about everything. And that process of sort of first having to teach the people that you collaborate with really accentuates the creativity process. It really amps it up, identifies where your weak points are. They're kind of your first audience. And that really helps us as a team craft these things to hopefully be successfully educational and entertaining for large audiences.
It's cool to hear how you can work with a team and everyone's got these different roles. And it's a pretty small team considering how often you're able to post and how good the videos are. So it's interesting to hear that. And 2 months is a long time. That's awesome.
Yeah, some videos come together really fast, you know, in a week or two. Like, it's just like all of the information falls in your lap and it just clicks. But that blue butterfly video that you mentioned, I think we were working on that one for about 6 months, because it turns out nobody had ever explained it on the internet correctly. Like, there was plenty of YouTube videos about why blue butterflies are blue. Once we started asking experts who actually work on this in bird and insect coloration, they were like, oh, nobody's done it right yet. Then you got to back up and you're like, well, I'm not a physicist, and you got to accomplish something nobody's ever done. And that means you're just, nobody works on why butterflies are blue. It's just not like you don't walk into labs and that's like a professional blueologist. You got to like dig in the academic world to find that one researcher who just knows why. And that is a detective process. And that is so much of this work. You just feel like Sherlock Holmes sometimes. You're just, you know, on the trail, and then finally it cracks for you, and it's the greatest feeling.
It's so funny, like, the level of nicheness that you can find when you look for it.
Yeah, and I guess having done this show now for 10 years and having so much success with it, we'd love to just hear about how you became interested in science communication and how you kind of got your start in this career.
Well, it was a long time ago. The world was black and white. No, it seems like an eternity to work on the internet for this long, as long as I have, because it's doing science communication on the internet has already been like three or four different things, like different eras. So it's been really interesting to kind of adapt to that. But going back to grad school, it's probably, you know, 12, 13 years ago, I'm sitting there like looking into the future and I'm like, I don't know if I really want to commit to three postdocs and everything that's going to come along with that. And I feel like there's something else out there for me. And some fellow grad students and I had started doing public science events in Austin, where I live and went to school. And we were doing it this in the real world with real people. Like grad students would come up and give kind of like working on like learning how to give public talks. We'd work with faculty. We'd put on these shows around town, you know, nothing special, but we're trying to deliver science to the people and show them why it's important, like directly from our university. And this was a time of incredible explosion on the internet. This was like the golden age, the curve going up of social media. Like Facebook was still very cool and growing. Twitter had just been launched. I don't think Instagram was even a thing yet. I hung out on Tumblr a lot. And so I had this idea one day, because I knew a lot of people who had blogs. Those were a thing back then. People read them. It's like a Substack that you didn't have to pay for. And I had this idea from talking to people that were getting kind of cynical. They were like, people just aren't paying attention to science anymore. You know, they're not, I think we're losing this battle, whatever that is. And I had a different idea. I think my hypothesis was that people are still interested in science, young people especially. They didn't lose that. It's just that the world had become more fragmented. These communities were popping up. Like people were hanging out in different places and they weren't going to come to you at the New York Times science section to get a dose of science. You have to go where the people are. And this sounds like so obvious in 2023 when you're thinking about how social media works. But at the time, this was kind of a new idea. So I started posting short science stuff all over Tumblr and all over these growing social media sites. I think I was rewarded with timing and luck for a little bit, but obviously it struck a nerve and it exploded. You know, the work I was doing got incredible reach and like beyond my wildest dreams, you know, just, and that means the hypothesis was correct. There were people out there that were interested, we just weren't reaching them because they were, the world had shattered into all these micro communities. And then at the top of that page, I wrote this saying that I wanted people to remember called, "It's okay to be smart," which is what evolved into what is now Be Smart, the show. But I didn't really mean to call it that. It just sort of people started calling it that because I put that motto there and I was like, well, I guess that's what it's called now. You can tell I'm not trained in marketing or any of that stuff, but YouTube is of course exploding at the same time. Shows like SciShow, Minute Physics, Vsauce, Smarter Every Day, you know, this like old guard of science YouTube was just starting to like really reach the front page of YouTube, like frequently, like, whoa, there are millions of people out there who want this stuff. And I loved watching those things. I used them in my classes with my students. And I was like, I could probably do that. I know how to work a camera. This was Dunning-Kruger effect, by the way, setting in before I knew what that was. And I decided I wanted to try my hand at video. And just at that moment, the great people at PBS, or public broadcasting here in the US, were launching this amazing experimental project where they wanted to make shows for people with the ideals of public media, like being accessible to everyone, driven by nonprofit ideals, information first, mission-based stuff, but doing it on the internet and kind of like getting weird and experimenting with all with the strange things that happen on places like YouTube. And met them and our minds just melded and it seemed like a perfect fit to adapt what we were doing to video. And the rest is history. The first videos were cheap and done very badly. And it's been a learning process for the last 10 years about how to better teach people things effectively, how to better talk about difficult and controversial subjects, how to take complex and hard to handle heavy science and make it accessible and fun and relevant to people. You know, I still feel like I'm learning that every day for the past 10 years. And it's been successful enough that our team has gotten to grow. We get to do better and fancier things, talk to amazing people, go to absolutely mind-blowing places, but we get to share that and hopefully people get to learn something out of it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You talk about having gone through this transition of like early YouTube to now. Have you found that there is a different way of having to communicate now, even on YouTube on the same platform? Or have you been able to use a lot of the same strategies? I know you're budget might be bigger than those, you know, first handful of videos, but do you find that people still respond to the stories you're telling in a similar way?
Yeah, I mean, our budget's not that much bigger. We're not Mr. Beast or Mark Rober as much as we would wish, but it's like we're super thankful for our community, and we have really passionate fans that support the show, and we're able to keep this going. Like that's incredible. Like that's a success for science. You know, that's hard to do, as anybody who tries to put a project like this together knows. But yeah, you know, I don't think the strategies we use to tell stories have changed. Viewers are a lot more savvy on YouTube. People have just watched so much stuff by now that like viewers are very professional. You know, they know what they like and what they don't like. But at the same time, you have to make sure you're not just trying to fit your work into the mold of what exists, of everything that has come before. And you're just making more of the same. Like there's a fine art of copying when you're learning how to be a creator. You want to assemble a lot of influences. You want to mimic and understand how the people that you look up to think and why they do what they do. Every artist has done this. But the great art is then combining your influences to be like no one else's influences, and then creating something that feels kind of new. That's never changed, and that won't change. As a few, you know, there are some of the most famous people on the entire internet are YouTubers. Some of the most famous and most recognizable celebrities on earth are YouTubers. And they can certainly drive what audiences expect to see, like what they think a YouTube video is supposed to look like. We're not doing challenges or running, you know, doing vlogs on the street about science. You know, we're trying to tell a story in a certain way because we have a different mission. It's to make people learn something or ask them to learn something and just make them better navigators of the universe. And that's a totally different experience than somebody laughing at the last person to take their hand off the private jet so they get to own it, right? Like YouTube is big enough that all this can exist. And that's the thing that's really changed the most. More and more people are on there looking for stuff. And we know that most of them go to learn something. It might be to learn woodworking or what to make for dinner or how to do their makeup. Or it might be how massive groups of plankton move up and down in the ocean. You know, people can have different experiences. And YouTube has gotten very good at giving you that experience when you open up the website. So I don't think our strategies have changed. They become more refined as we know what people like. We do have to design our stories to sort of fit the format of a YouTube video. You know, you have like 10 seconds to get somebody's attention. Otherwise, they're off, you know, and then there's the other 12 things they're being asked to click on. But, you know, videos have gotten longer. People are willing to invest more of their time in these experiences, and that's let us tell deeper, more rewarding stories. Looking back, like my old videos were like 4 minutes long. And now I'm like, how can I explain anything in 4 minutes? No, I need like at least 10. So that part has changed. But I think that's another blessing because it shows that this is the primary, you know, visual medium of our time. It lets us tell these just much richer tales and give you just a much deeper experience and tell a much more resonant story. We're still driven by algorithms, though, so like that's something we have to keep an eye on. You know, you don't want to just be chasing the dopamine hits of trying to please a computer. You have to remember that there are people at the other end of these videos clicking that, and that's what you want to be connecting with. You're not pleasing an algorithm; you're pleasing people.
Yeah, this is really, I think, interesting and helpful for us as, I guess, science communicators coming up in a different, I guess, time of the internet. And there is a lot of pressure, I think, like trying to get viral videos on TikTok and things like that. But I know for Olivia and I, our experience, we started this during the pandemic, and it's really just been such an amazing way to connect with people. And, you know, we don't have the size of listenership that you do, but just the people that we have been able to connect with are just the most amazing fans and other science communicators. And I think what you said about there's space for everything, and like it really feels like between communicators and creators, there isn't this scarcity mindset that I thought that there would be. Like there's space for everyone and for us all to collaborate, which is really amazing.
Yeah, it's a very like, if we help each other out, everyone benefits. And I think that's really, I can't imagine a better community mindset than that. So
that's always been universal in my experience with science communication. Like everybody's, for the most part, very cool and open. And yeah, there were amazing people I looked up to that actually answered my questions and gave me the time of day coming up. And that kind of stuff has made all the difference. And you're not going to fill up the internet, okay? Like there's room for everybody. There's billions of people on Earth and they're all looking at their phones for better or worse. And it's been so great to watch creators come up in other countries and doing things that are relevant and valuable to their communities. Like we're still in this incredible growth era of this. There's tough stuff to figure out about how you support this stuff and how you enable people to do this professionally and invest the resources that it takes. Like educational content is hard. It's expensive. Like you're not just flipping the camera on and like giving your thoughts, right? It takes research. It's hard to do this stuff. But we've seen that if you give people something valuable, you provide them with value, then they'll return that value to you. They'll support that because it's important to them. It's not empty time-wasting program. It's life-improving content.
Definitely. Is there anything else you'd like to add about Plankton or the migration or SciComm or anything we've talked about or haven't talked about?
If I had to pick a favorite migration, it might be the Plankton one just by scale, but I never got to touch it or see it. Like that's something I still hope to be able to do. So if anybody out there with a submarine wants to take me down, totally game. But I love any time that I get to unlock that discovery that seemingly simple creatures with like a million brain cells at the most are able to do things at the scale and complexity of like the monarch butterfly migration is a genuine experience of awe at nature and kind of humbling for any curious person because you're like, you thought you had it figured out. You thought you knew something and nature just is full of surprises to keep putting you back in your place and be like, no, 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 you're still a baby. You have lots more to learn. And that's the feeling that I think keeps me going every day, whether it's Plankton or whatever other cool migration we'll cover next or anything else that we do on the channel.
Totally. I think, yeah, even the part where in the video you're talking about like the clouds passing over and that affecting even where they are in the water column, that is amazing. That is not just a fluke. There's so much complexity there. And I think it's so cool when we can determine anything about behavior and activity of things that are this small because it is not easy to observe. And sometimes it has to be as big as like the biggest migration on the planet for us to even notice it. So it's amazing to think of all those smaller scale things and behaviors that are also happening that we may never be able to observe because they're just existing in a total different, almost plane of existence than we are.
Yeah. I mean, think about the fact that you're stuck to the Earth and can move in like two dimensions, like the original Zelda on Nintendo, basically. A plankton lives like a whole dimension of complexity, different life than you. Cause it has, the ocean is a huge three-dimensional thing. Like most animals on Earth that live on land, they're just stuck to the land all the time. Birds can like get a little bit up in the air for a while till they get tired and got to come back down and eat. But man, everything that lives in the ocean is in this like crazy three-dimensional, just an enormous potential ecosystem. And there's, we know more about some other planets than we know about our oceans. And I think that's just another humbling reminder of how much there is out there to learn. So when everybody goes to sleep tonight or any night, you can remember that there are tiny plankton in the ocean with the same like hormonal circuitry going on that makes you sleepy is making them move up and down in the water column. And that shouldn't make you feel insignificant or boring. It should make you feel awesome and connected to one of the coolest things on the planet Earth.
That's amazing. I love that message to end this. I'm going to be thinking about that so much. And that's why I love writing about the ocean, not just nonfiction, but like poetry, fiction. It's just an endless supply of inspiration and wonder.
Are you saying it's deep?
Yeah.
Yeah, the ocean.
I also will be thinking about that a lot.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us to talk about all of this. And please remind our listeners again where they can find you and the show online.
I'm on social media at Dr. Joe Hansen, Dr. Joe Hansen. And you can find the show on YouTube. Just search for Be Smart, and there are hundreds of enjoyable educational experiences waiting for you. Like and subscribe.
Yes.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed chatting with Joe. He has so much knowledge, and I've been such a fan of his show for so long. I hope you all go check out Be Smart on YouTube and enjoy the literal hundreds of videos on there. Like, you will be entertained for days.
Yeah, thank you again so much to Joe for coming on. It was just such a treat to be able to talk to him about Plankton and his career and science communication and YouTube, early YouTube. I don't know. So fascinating.
Yeah, it's so fun to talk to other science communicators because I feel like it's such a cool job and it's so interesting to hear everyone's different takes on it. So thanks everyone for listening. And yeah, thanks Joe for coming on. Remember to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/beyondblathers and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at beyondblathers. You can also find our TikTok at beyond_blathers. Wow, we have a lot of links and usernames now. It's almost like we have a link tree that people can click on to find all those links.
We're adding.
You're feeling a little lost.
And don't forget to take a look at our Etsy shop, which we also have at etsy.com/shop/beyondblathers.
It's so many. Lots of places to find us. So tune in next week to learn more about the insects, fish, and fossils you can find in Animal Crossing New Horizons. Bye.
Bye.